welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Dr. Lance DeHaven-Smith. Lance is a professor emeritus at the School of Public Administration and Policy at Florida State University, a former president of the Florida Political Science Association. He's the author, co-author, or editor of 15 books on topics ranging from religion and political philosophy to Florida government and politics. Lance, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Listen, thanks for coming on the show.
I'm glad to be on it.
Well, here we're talking about, today we're talking about your book, Conspiracy Theory in America. And in that book, you write about how in the not-so-distant past, Americans were taught to be ever vigilant for political misconduct and how this healthy suspicion of concentrated power has been replaced with a widespread public gullibility, which treats suspicion of criminal wrongdoing at the highest levels of government as paranoid thinking akin to a superstition. How do you explain this transformation in public mindset or thought?
Well, what I discovered through a search of the New York Times, you know, it's only recently that we've gotten the ability to go into the past and identify publications by searching and everything. So I searched on conspiracy theory, and I found an article about a 1967 CIA memo that was mistakenly declassified in 1976. And I got the memo. It's online. What it said was there was concern that people were questioning the Warren Commission conclusions about the Kennedy assassination, and they sent this memo to all of their station chiefs all over the world and said, if you come into contact with journalists that are talking about this, you know, tell them there's no evidence of a conspiracy and that these are just conspiracy theorists and they're in love with their own theories or they're trying to make money. And that's essentially what happened. The conspiracy theory concept became widely used and applied all over the place. And it took, you know, 20, 30 years, but it now is a very significant part of our political lexicon. I point out in the book that it's very un-American, really, to dismiss concerns or suspicions about high political crimes. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, it's what it would today be called a conspiracy theory. It says that everybody's familiar with the opening about inalienable rights and so on. But if you read the bulk of it, it is devoted to explaining that King George is plotting to deprive the colonists of their rights as English citizens. And it just lists the things that he's done: taxation without representation, stirring up the Indians, and many other things. And then it says, on the basis of all this, we have to conclude that the king is trying to subvert our rights, and we have a responsibility to throw off that yoke.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, that suspicion of government was firm all the way up through World War II. And it only, we only became this naive population beginning in the 60s. And today, if you say, well, I think it's interesting. I have to say, nobody's calling the questions about President Trump conspiracy theory. It seems in this case, people consider that a legitimate suspicion. So maybe things are changing. But, for the last several decades, we basically poo-pooed every suspicion of elite political criminality in our country. Now, we don't poo-poo it when it's in Russia or Italy or any place like that. You know, people say, yeah, it was the government that did it. But our country, you know, quit doing that. And we think of ourselves as special. All the other governments have these problems, but we don't. We don't do assassinations, and we don't have election tampering. And what got me into this, just a little aside, was I live in Tallahassee, Florida, and I was a professor at Florida State during the 2000 disputed election. And I watched it and realized that people at the highest level of government were breaking the law and blocking a legally mandated recount. And they did all kinds of things. But I thought that it would be investigated afterwards, and we would, you know, correct these crimes and punish the people who did them. And it turned out there was no investigation afterwards. There was a little committee put together that attributed everything to the technology, to the punch cards. And so anyway, I saw that, and I was really outraged by it. I wrote a book about it called The Battle for Florida. But then the same thing happened in 2004 in Ohio. And I was like, good grief. You mean we're not going to investigate that? I mean, it's just like what happened in 2000, almost exactly. You had the voting machines were inadequate numbers in urban areas where the Democrats are concentrated. There was a culling of the voter list. There was confusion at the polls. There were very suspicious statistical anomalies in the voting returns. And so on. And nobody looked at it like, well, they've done it again. And I realized that we don't think of elite political crimes the way we think of ordinary crimes. Ordinary crime, we look for patterns. And, you know, if a man marries a wealthy woman and she dies in the bathtub from a fall, we're suspicious of it because it's an improbable event and he benefited from it. Now, if he marries again and a woman falls off the roof of the house or something and is killed, we would be highly suspicious of it. And, you know, if a third scenario happened like that, we would exhume the bodies and prosecute, you know, certainly. But in elite political crime, we don't look for those patterns, specifically because we consider any search for that is a conspiracy theory. And you've got to be suspicious to look for the links. And so what I did after I came to this conclusion, I said, well, you know, there's not a name for this kind of crime. Is it high crime is what it used to be called. But there's not a name for it, and therefore it's hard to talk about it because you get labeled as a conspiracy theorist. And so I came up with this term, State Crimes Against Democracy, or SCAD, in an effort to name the phenomenon that we're discouraged from speaking about. And it's not a great term, you know, but it does its work. It allows us to look at a category of crime, like juvenile crime or fraud or organized crime. It's a type of crime. And so we can identify these crimes and begin looking at patterns in them. And that's what I did. And it shocked me, to be honest with you. I did a list of these suspicious political events, like John Kennedy's assassination, Robert Kennedy's assassination. You know, that one struck me. I had never thought about it, but we always call the Kennedy assassination, that's John Kennedy. If you want to say Bobby Kennedy, you have to specifically say Robert Kennedy. And we never talk about assassinations, plural. the Kennedy assassinations, which is what we should talk about. We just talk about them in very separate terms. It's the same thing, you know, if you look at 9/11, you know, there were the anthrax letter attacks immediately after that. And those should have been viewed and were initially viewed as connected. But when the government found out that the strain of anthrax had been produced at the, by the U.S. Army, they, you know, stopped talking about it and tried to find somebody to hang on. And they blamed one person initially, and he sued them and won. And then they blamed another guy who committed suicide. But it's just, you know, it's just a tendency in the country to look at these events as what the British call one-offs, you know, one of a kind.
When they're really looked at them as sort of serial events related.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Serial events. And take a simple case. Just about everybody who ran against Richard Nixon got shot.
Yes.
John Kennedy. Robert Kennedy was killed after winning the California Democratic primary. And that was in, Nixon was going to be the nominee. And then in 1972, when Nixon was running for re-election, George Wallace, a Southern segregationist, ran on an independent ticket, and it looked like he could draw maybe six or seven states, in which case Nixon could be deprived of his re-election. But then he, you know, George Wallace gets shot. So we've got these three people that ran against Nixon and all got whacked. Now, in any normal, you know, any normal investigation, you would be saying, well, the person who benefits was Nixon. Let's go find out what he was doing. And yet we don't look at it that way.
And in all three cases, whether it's Arthur Bremer in 72 shooting George Wallace and paralyzing him, intending to kill him, I assume, or yes. Sirhan, firing at Bobby in front of him. Of course,
right.
Bobby is killed by a shot from behind the ear. And also Lee Harvey Oswald, the problems with it, you know, with him being the lone nut.
Yeah.
All these cases, if anyone just does a cursory examination of the evidence, you wouldn't have to be very skeptical that the official narratives are true in all three cases.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, think about it. You know, President Kennedy gets shot in the middle of the afternoon, in the middle of the street, and supposedly this guy got off three shots, and two of them hit Kennedy, and then he's arrested in strange circumstances and is interrogated for 2 days, and nobody takes notes or records the interrogation, and then he is killed while in police custody at police headquarters. Now, if you're not suspicious of that, you're an idiot.
And he declares himself a patsy.
So. Yeah, he said it. And I suspect he was. I mean, our government is sort of we develop these skills, and then they migrate over here, but back to our country. We apply them to other countries. We were doing assassinations in the 50s and in the 60s, and then that shows up in the United States, a string of them. It was Malcolm X and President John Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy and George Wallace. You know, just a string of them. And it is kind of amazing when you sit down and look at a list of these and you start realizing these things happen pretty darn often.
And of course, the questions regarding the attempt on Reagan's life in 1981 because of the connection.
That's right. And that was, you know, look at that. That was 3 months after he was in office. So Bush, his vice president, would have gotten, you know, basically a full term. And Bush, the Hinckley, the guy who shot President Reagan, was George Bush said he didn't know him. He never heard of him and didn't know his family. Well, it turned out his family donated a lot of money to his campaigns, and even one of the Bush brothers was supposed to eat dinner with one of Hinckley's brothers that night, the night of this, of the attempted assassination. You know, it's just one thing after another, and you see, you know, these very similar crimes carried out almost exactly the same way. It's like once they get a way to do it, they bring it back to the United States. I think, you know, if you look at the color revolutions around the Eastern Bloc of countries and in the Middle East, what is happening today in our politics looks a lot like those color revolutions.
Yeah, stirring up the trouble.
Yeah,
divide and conquer. Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter.
Right.
You know, the emerging national white identity or national white nationalism. These things can all be stirred up, and have a few agent provocateurs with some funding. It's of course there's George Soros' operation, and then there's the other side. You know, that does this as well. So it's part of a dialectic that's being played out, I think.
I think so, and it's been a rude awakening for America. I think that, you know, they're going to have to. It's going to be hard to process. There are going to be congressional inquiries on the relationship between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And we already know there was collusion in the Democratic primaries to move Secretary Clinton to get her the nomination. So, I mean, you know, these crimes are pretty common now.
Yeah.
It's like we're generating into a something like a, well, it's not really a banana republic. It's it's just an illusion. we don't know what to believe.
Yeah, I think you call it a holographic government.
Yeah, that was Matt Witt's term for it, holographic government.
Yeah. Now,
I thought that was, yeah.
Yeah, you of course you mentioned Declaration of Independence and its allusions to conspiracy plotting and all that. There's also the United States Constitution, which in its basic structure competing governments.
Yeah, checks and balances.
Checks and balances.
Pitting these branches against each other. It's all designed on the basis of the fear of political power becoming concentrated and abusing the citizens' rights.
You're checking ambition with ambition.
But what happened was, and George Washington wrote this in his farewell address, we formed political parties, and once you did that, you could have scenarios where the same party controlled two or three branches, and then they could collude, or at least not check each other. And but you know, we've always been suspicious of concentrated political power until John Kennedy was killed, and then we decided there was no such thing.
that was an inflection point, both politically and culturally in the United States and in the world, because that's kind of like when the '60s began. Which some people think was much of the counterculture was, if not engineered, was manipulated by the powers that be.
Yeah.
And of course, if you understand that the CIA and intelligence agencies and the powers that be are very concerned with culture creation and manipulating, we'll probably get into that, you know, with the manipulation of information with the press, the Mockingbird and the Mighty Wurlitzer. But you do, in the early part of the book, you get into this different conspiracy theories at least how it was approached, and you get these three different scholars, which I found was interesting. Mm-hmm. Was one thing I wanted to is that before I get into that is we the oath of allegiance to the Constitution that people in the military take, government officials take. Part of it says, "I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic."
Domestic, right.
Domestic.
It assumes there could be some domestic enemies.
And that would, I presume, would mean there would have to be a conspiracy. I don't think it's a lone nut that's going to take down the Republic, right? It would have to be a conspiracy.
Right.
So there we go, right? Now,
well, they had, you know, the first guy that got tried for treason, Aaron Burr, was conspiring with the military in the Western Territories to create a new country, you know. And so they, the founders, had these elite criminals right in their midst. So they were not naive about this by any means.
Mm-hmm. How could anyone who's familiar with history be not be familiar with the threat of conspiracy and political power? But you you bring up these three scholars, historians and philosophers, and it's Charles Beard's approach to conspiracy theory, Karl Popper, and of course Leo Strauss, the godfather of the neoconservatives. Do you want to spell those out? Charles Beard, Karl Popper, and Leo Strauss.
Yeah, Charles Beard is Charles Beard was the most famous social scientist in the United States in the first three or four decades of the 20th century. He was president of both the American Political Science Association and the American Historical Association. And he wrote a book, and he wrote a book after Pearl Harbor, where he said that the administration, the Roosevelt administration, knew the attack was coming, knew where it was, knew when it was, and they didn't warn the commanders in the Pacific because they wanted us to enter World War II. You know, with a vengeance. And he documented this extremely well. I don't think there's any, I think it's withstood criticism. Unfortunately, it's not mentioned anymore. It was like airbrushed out of the history of political science.
Yeah.
And
he's been largely vindicated with the evidence, I think.
Yeah. And we had broken the Japanese codes.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. It was FDR's backdoor to war, as someone else said.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And Beard, he said that this was common, that the people that he thought of it like the government insiders would put things in the institutions, in the laws and the constitutions to advantage the wealthy elites. And he said, you don't just theorize about it. Once you think that's happened, you go in and dig out the records. And, you know, he was very clear that he didn't want just any old conspiracy theory floating around, but he was also very clear that we needed to take these things seriously and investigate them. And he was, you know, basically ruined after that. He died shortly after the book came out. It was on the bestseller list for 9 weeks or so, and it was very controversial. Nobody remembers it now.
And if you look at things like the federal assumption of debt, that was sort of like a conspiracy when the money elite in New York and Alexander Hamilton. Yeah. But he talked. Yeah, the Constitution sort of the property, the rentier, creditor class benefiting from that. He also mentions, I think you mentioned it too, his idea of the 14th Amendment, right? A corporate conspiracy.
Yes, the conspiracy theory of the 14th Amendment. And, you know, ironically, this is in a Supreme Court decision. It's not a theory. But he dug this out, and
is that Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific Railroad?
I don't know. It sounds like it.
Okay.
It was the business elites were conspiring to have the 14th Amendment worded in such a way that corporations would have the rights of persons. Yes. And they, you know, they got on the inside and worked with the people who were drafting it and got the language. And then they ended up going to court later, and in the Supreme Court asked, well, what was the intention of the drafters? And they said, well, it was to treat corporations like persons. And the Supreme Court, instead of saying, well, that's an outrageous conspiracy, how dare you do that, they said, oh, okay, that was the intent, so that's how we'll interpret it.
That's fascinating, because up until then, the understanding of a corporation in the United States was a charter with a specific purpose and limited time.
Right? Absolutely. It was. Yeah. Most of them were like toll roads and canals and stuff. They had to have a public purpose, and then now they've taken over the world.
Well, because you have a person with what they call limited liability, right?
Right.
And I think it was the application of the Equal Protection Clause to corporations that.
Right.
Yeah. In which,
that's what it was.
And what he's saying was that when they wrote the 14th Amendment, which under the guise of a Reconstruction Amendment, the post-Civil War amendment, expanding civil rights to all Americans, I guess directed at the freed slaves, the recently freed slaves. But they're riding on that to slip in this thing. So, because remember, this is around the time that the railroads were, Lincoln had signed the railroad bill, and so a whole bunch of, like the Credit Mobile affair, the scandals, and all that, all this bribery, political, all this conspiracy, right, around the railroads.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
Ask the Indians about that, right? so that's fascinating, because that's a perfect environment for that type of conspiracy if you think about it.
And it's just, Beard said was this was a fairly common thing, and you had to watch out for it. And basically, his science was how to document these things. So, where do you go to find the paperwork on these kinds of things? And that was one of his firm principles: get paperwork, get documents. And if you look at it, that's really the way it works. If you don't have documents, it's just you, somebody said it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also bring up Karl Popper, and it's kind of like you kind of blame him for sort of this gullible attitude people have today towards conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
He sort of poo-pooed the whole idea. What was his
approach? Yeah, I think his approach, he talked about the conspiracy theory of society. He said if you had a conspiracy theory of one event, that you were basically saying that the whole society was a conspiracy. And there was no real logic in this. It's kind of ironic that he's a philosopher and credited with being a pretty sharp mind. Although I have to tell you, when Leo Strauss read this, he said the guy was an idiot. he just really blasted him. But Popper discouraged what we would call philosophy, political theorizing. I mean, he wrote a political theory against political theory. He said what we needed to do in social science was focus on specific settings and look at the behavior of people in those settings, such as voters going into the polling booth, bureaucrats in the government. And that this gradually became the way the social sciences function, and they really don't do much theorizing at a higher level. They call it mid-range theory. And it had a huge effect on the social sciences, and they became, blind to these crimes because you don't look at conspiracies. You don't look at, you look at voting behavior. I mean, think about this. In 1968, Bobby Kennedy was killed. No, let's take the Watergate, 72. Nixon maneuvered the Democratic Party nomination process to get the weakest candidate nominated, George McGovern. And he really was weak. He picked a guy for vice president who ended up having had electroshock therapy. So he had to dump him.
Was that Eagleton, if I recall?
Yes. Yeah. Ooh, you're good. But, you know, he manipulated the election. Well, the political scientists analyzed that election like it wasn't stolen. You know, they just analyze it like it was a regular election, and mm-hmm. they look at the voting behavior and public opinion and run regression analysis to show that the poor people voted one way and the rich people voted another way. But nobody looks at it like, hey, this was a stolen election. And that's what we need to understand. What the social scientists are looking at is all downstream from the criminality. You have these big crimes carried out, and then the social scientists ignore them and focus on the little minutia downstream. And it's a tragedy, but I would attribute that to Popper.
So what you're saying is, later, okay, I'm sorry, what you're saying ahead. Is Karl Popper, his job there, I guess you could say, was to steer academia in a certain direction, make it so there when they studied political science and elections, and to make it a very academic approach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I think it was a I don't know what I'd call it, a conspiracy, but it was something that the academic elite decided that it was dangerous to have these conspiracy theories about the Jews, about financiers and things like that. And so we had to get rid of that so we didn't risk having the rise of totalitarian leaders in our society. So it became, you know, a big movement, but it was almost invisible. They called it the behavioral revolution, but it was basically this Popper's idea. Now they have a term called rational choice theory, which is the same thing. It's looking at people in a concrete setting and saying what's rational for them to do in this setting, and seeing if they do it. But it's, again, you know, it's like looking at a elephant through a microscope. It's, you know, you just miss the big picture.
And also they overlook the utter criminality and illegality of the political class.
Exactly.
Yeah,
there's no, we ought to have a field, you know, forensic political science that investigates these things and categorizes the crimes and tells us how to research them. But, you know, we don't.
Well, yeah, you're like, it's almost like if you look at the conspiracy throughout history, at least in American history, there were traditional concerns regarding the, the intrigues of Freemasonry or Illuminism.
Right.
But, you know, you can always take these theories to the extreme and sort of draw a caricature of them to discredit them. But nevertheless, to think that organized crime or political scheming or skullduggery or the efforts of, say, a political grouping or an ethnic group, they're not going to organize themselves and behave collectively or organize themselves politically,
right,
or to protect their financial interests is just simply naive. And someone like Popper would go in, he discredited that line of inquiry to leave them free to engage in their high crimes and misdemeanors, right?
Yes, exactly. And made it, you know, contributed to the idea that people who have these theories have a, you know, complete delusional view of society, that it's entirely all conspiracy. And that's not what these ideas are like. I mean, these ideas are things like, we suspect that the government may have been involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. And, you know, it's a very specific thing. It's not conspiracy theory of the whole society, but that's what he said. And people began to just dismiss any kind of really critical scholarship that that talked about crime. I mean, that's the interesting thing to me is nobody talks about crime, elite political crime. You can talk about scandals. You can talk about suspicions. You can talk about rare coincidences, but you don't talk about crime. It's like taboo in America.
Yeah, and if anyone who looks into these things, whether it's the political environment of, say, 1963, and if you look into what Kennedy was doing and what was going on, you know, with the Pentagon, and Curtis LeMay, and
and the Bay of Pigs, and then the nuclear testing treaty with the Soviets, and the Cuban Missile Crisis, they thought Kennedy was a coward. And that he was selling out the country, and there was no way to impeach him without bringing out all this evidence of his affairs, and it would have taken at least 2 years, and so they had to. I think of it, they had to kill him in their minds to save the republic, and then. And then they had to cover it up, and they did pass an amendment to the Constitution after that that allows you to take the president out of the office if the cabinet officials agree that the person can't carry out the functions. Mm-hmm. I think that could happen to Trump, for example. If he was found to have a lot of tight connections with the Soviet Union, the argument could be made that he can't carry out U.S. policy in the public interest and therefore is not fit to serve. And they can remove him, I mean, immediately. Now, he gets a chance to appeal, and it eventually goes to a vote. But it's interesting that after the Kennedy assassination, that's what they did. Worked a deal where you could get rid of the president.
And you also, the third guy, Leo Strauss, his idea of the noble eye and the importance of public myths and maintaining a liberal society, which I think is rather ironic.
Yes. He Strauss, I've read virtually everything he wrote. He's a brilliant scholar. But he was a Platonist. He thought that the ancient political philosophers, the Greeks, didn't say out loud what they thought. And his view was that any person with an open mind in any society, if they speak their mind, they will get into trouble because the societies are always based on myths. The historical events that are glorified that didn't necessarily happen. Think of George Washington cutting down the cherry tree and, you know, the founding fathers and things like that. Well, when you look at those guys, they were slaveholders. They dueled with each other. they intrigued right and left. Washington had a brewery. he made liquor, and he had these big parties when he was running for president. He gave away liquor. Abraham Lincoln, he moved the troops around to advantage his reelection in 1864. So he could have them in the states where he needed votes. So, I mean, this kind of stuff is – very common. And Strauss said, you can't talk about it without getting into trouble, but you do need to talk to the political elites and the academic elites. You need to be able to tell them what the story is, that their leaders are not all they're cracked up to be. He thought that democracies were slow to face a gathering cloud of aggression, and that you had to basically lie to them and scare them to keep them vigilant against these threats that are all around us. And he did this. He wrote this without exactly saying that. You know, he wrote a series, you know, a tremendous series of articles on specific political documents. Plato's Republic, and he went through everything that Plato had done and pointed out that Socrates, the speaker in most of the dialogues, would say different things in front of different people. He would contradict himself later. And Strauss took that to mean that he was being careful. He could talk to his students pretty openly, but when there was another philosopher there giving him a hard time, like Thrasymachus, he couldn't speak his mind, and so he would have to equivocate and hair split and all of that. But Strauss, he is the most influential political philosopher in the history of the United States, aside from the Founders and the Federalist Papers. His ideas penetrated the elite, and they call them neoconservatives.
That's right. They're all Straussians now, as they say. Right?
They're all Straussians. That's exactly what.
And you could say
it came out of the University of Chicago.
Yeah,
That's where he taught. And
an example of that would be last fall when the WikiLeaks emails came out with Hillary Clinton. When she said, I think that admitted in a talk to Goldman Sachs that she talks differently to them than she does to the public. That's very Straussian.
Yes, that's very Straussian. And, there are other things. He kind of suggests, and this follows Plato, he had the Nocturnal Council. This was a council that met at night. This is in the a dialogue called The Laws. But you get the people together, a handful, who really love the government and are totally patriotic and will kill or do anything to keep the republic alive. And it suggests that there may be a cabal in high places as we speak. The Project for a New American Century, if you look at the signatures on that, it looks like a pretty good example of this. So, but Strauss, if you take Strauss seriously, what you've got to say is the elites are going to lie to you. That's their job. And if you call them on it, they'll call you a liar.
One thing I thought was interesting was you detail the some of these SCADs, lesser known ones, sort of like the original October Surprise when Nixon conspired to prolong the Vietnam War with Kissinger in order to ensure his victory in 1968 against Hubert Humphrey. And that LBJ was aware of this. That's an interesting story because it gets into political skullduggery on both sides of the aisle.
Johnson knew about this. We know Johnson knew about it because we have a tape of him talking to Everett Dirksen, a senior Republican in the Senate. And he's telling Dirksen, you've got to make Nixon quit this. It's treason. But he goes on to say, but I'm not going to tell the American people because it would destroy their confidence in the government. Now, I think that's a motive of the elite that we have to take very seriously. They are willing to sacrifice elections or even lives to keep faith in the government. And they apparently are pretty scared that it's not all that stable. And they have to, watch out for dissidents and social movements and rich rogues. So it's
You were saying how you looked at Nixon. Nixon was a crook. He was paranoid. He was unethical. Couldn't trust him. He was a liar. Then you realized the more you looked into it, the more you studied political science and Washington politics in general, you realized they're all that way.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't get ahead if you're not. if they play by the rules, they can't win. And you have that 1968 October surprise. It's very similar to what President Trump is being accused of, his campaign. Working with a foreign power to win an election. And, I think we ought to, have that as a category of SCAD, a category of high crime. We need a name for it, and we need to codify it in the laws, and we need special punishments for it. I mean, these people, what we do now is we let them all go. Okay, when Kennedy gets shot, the guy who benefited was Johnson. He appoints the investigative committee, which is all a bunch of cronies, and they put out a report that even, a couple of their own members said was inadequate and incorrect, but, there was no consequence. Nobody was called, was accused. When Nixon was taken before the Watergate Commission and all that, and Gerald Ford became vice president, Ford worked a deal out with Nixon to pardon him if Nixon would resign, so Ford could become president and have some time in office before the 1976 election. And the funny thing about it is, if you go look at that pardon of Nixon, you got to ask, how do you pardon somebody for something they haven't been tried for?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems to me they have to be convicted and then you can pardon them. But what Ford did was he issued a blanket pardon, a pardon for any crimes that President Nixon might have committed while in the presidency. That's a get out of jail free card if I ever saw one. So you think about that, George W. Bush lying us into war, the Iran-Contra thing, the October surprise of 1980. None of this has led to any really serious punishment. What they always say, they're not going to investigate. Well, they may investigate her, but I would be amazed if they did anything to her.
Well, the crimes of the Clinton and Bush families, I think, unearthed the whole evil or corrupt system.
Yeah,
they're all part. Yeah, yeah. Because you're getting into not only illegal arms shipments, drug running, MENA, Arkansas, the whole deep state.
Yeah.
They're agents of the deep state. So you'll never get a full vetting because.
I'm trying to figure out who Trump is.
Well, I know that's a whole other show. But now, of course, a lot of this they get away with it. They're never criminally charged or brought to. You make a good point about impeachment in your book, and I've heard you in various talks you've given that impeachment does not require a high threshold of proof.
No.
And it meaning it's kind of vague, but these are political crimes, and no office holder gets due process, meaning just high suspicion is enough to remove someone from office. Yeah.
It was based on the ostracism in ancient Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have to accuse anybody of a crime. If they just thought somebody was getting too powerful, they, through a vote in the assembly, could force them to leave the city for 10 years. And that's what impeachment was supposed to be. If you saw somebody and you didn't have a smoking gun, why the hell do you need a smoking gun when the person has all this power and can control the investigation and everything? You've got to be able to remove these people before they have a chance to do further damage. and you can't take a chance on it.
Because they control the they would control the criminal investigation, the technical investigation.
Yeah.
Whereas you got to treat them like a mob boss or office or like a king ordering someone rid me of this meddlesome priest. You don't have to give the order. There's a political machinery that does it for you, which you employ, which you build. And so it's sort of not, no one deserves to hold office. They serve at the privilege of the people, and the people's representatives can remove them if there's a reasonable suspicion. You can impeach a president for a bad haircut, technically.
And, when Andrew Johnson was impeached, one of the clauses was he had insulted the Congress. they're going to throw him out for insulting them. But that's the way it should work. If you had a leader who was flaunting the law and doing all kinds of things that seemed very suspicious, you shouldn't have to find a smoking gun to do something about it. Because look, when President Trump gets in office, he'll have control of the investigative machinery that is looking into him. And I would suspect that will stop. I think it'll be a very controversial thing. But, it happened. Nixon did the same thing. He fired the special prosecutor. They appointed one, and he fired him. He appointed another one. He fired him.
He set a massacre. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, these guys, we've really been sold a bill of goods by our government and by the scholars. I think the academics are very responsible for this. And one thing I like to point out, and this is a little extreme, but I wrote an article about the comparison between the Nuremberg war crimes and the Iraq war, the lying of into war. And one of the things I learned was in the Nuremberg war crimes trials, they tried the attorneys, they tried journalists, as well as the the people who gave the orders to kill people. They tried them. They tried the people who facilitated the subversion of their nation. And I think, we should have a similar attitude about our press and our academics, that if they are lulling us into turning us into sheep, we ought to be able to do something about it. And this goes a little far afield, but it really highlights the extent to which we have not codified into law the protections that we need to keep us a free people.
Now, you mentioned, of course, journalists, and maybe this is a good place to close the interview out on, is the role of journalism, the role of the so-called free press, the myth of a free press in this country. Now, if you go back, I go back as far back as 1917, I think Senator Oscar Calloway on the floor of the Senate had spoke about how the Wall Street interests, particularly J.P. Morgan, had bought a half a dozen or so major newspapers to control the narrative and that would control the flow of information in the country to facilitate the country's entry into World War I at the time. But of course, leading up to that, more recently, of course, we had the revelations of the church hearings with the Operation Mockingbird and what Frank Wisner, the old CIA, had called his mighty Wurlitzer, the ability to play America like an organ because the control over the media, entertainment, the press, Life magazine, Time Life, Hollywood.
Right.
This has all been integrated into the CIA because the CIA is an agency. It represents interests. And the interests are the corporate powers that be, which benefit from the American empire.
Right.
And you want to talk about this myth of a free press?
Well, the freedom of the press is constitutionally protected. It's the only right that, profession that has that status. So we ought to be able to require an honest press if they're going to have this kind of protection. But, you know, what has happened instead is, yes, the CIA infiltrated and put their own people all throughout the mass media. And what we read now is much of it just pure propaganda. And I think it's interesting that people now call it the mainstream press because there's such suspicion of it. Mm-hmm. I tend to think we're becoming like the Russians were at the end of the Soviet Union, where nobody believes the government. Nobody believes the press. Pravda, you know, I mean, New York Times is Pravda.
Well, you know what they say in Washington, D.C. is don't believe anything is true until it's officially denied, right?
That's excellent. Yeah, that sounds like it. Well, it's a shame. This is a great country, and you know, but it seems to be, you know, similar to the fall of Athens, the fall of Rome.
What was interesting here is, well, I mean, if you study the connections of the major networks and the news papers to the intelligence agencies, to the banking interests, it's all there.
Right.
You don't have to be a crazy conspiracy theorist to believe that. William Paley came out of, I think, OSS. Sarnoff was OWI.
These are
wartime intelligence agencies, psychological warfare agencies. Time Life Empire, Henry Luce, that was connected to Skull and Bones. That's CIA. It's the American century. This is the establishment. I mean, then the culture. I mean, people like they had Ms. Magazine and National Review were probably intelligence, CIA.
Ms. Magazine was funded by the CIA.
Yeah, Gloria Steinem.
Gloria Steinem, you know, the rabble rouser.
And that goes back.
You gotta wonder what was the CIA after? And my theory is they want to atomize us. They want us to not have the ability to gather around in collective action. They want us all, you know, just like the theory of rational choice. They want us all to be rats in a maze.
Yep.
With a narrow vision.
And that's MK Ultra, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Broad psychological manipulation of the country. But the CIA funded Ms. Magazine, and if the they funded Playboy Magazine. So
that's interesting.
They get all their bases covered. And of course, Gloria Steinem used to be a Playboy bunny.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that. Oh, you are good. I tell you, it's like an interesting conversation.
You know, and of course, you know, the whole idea of conspiracy theory from the CIA memo 1035-960 is to make it seem like we're crazy and to scare away anyone from listening to us. That's the
They're not trying to dispute the theories. They're talking to the people who don't know the theories and telling them it's not worth knowing. You know, just write it off. You don't have to go study the Kennedy assassination because you know it's a conspiracy theory and those are crazy.
So
they're shutting down our curiosity and our.
It's a war on cognition, right?
It is, and it's. You know, what they're doing, they've infiltrated the cultural sphere where, like in the election, where you're manipulating what gets in the news and what is discovered, what is kept. And so you're creating a public that is a kind of a robot. It does what the illusions are around them that lead them to particular conclusions. You know, there was a myth in Plato, the myth of the cave. And he said that government was like people living in a cave and they were set in a way where they couldn't turn their back, turn around, and behind them was a fire. And their actions cast shadows on the wall. But they didn't know what was doing it. And they were just following the shadows. And Plato said that, you know, philosophers came out of the cave and then went back later to help the people understand what was going on. I think a more accurate view would be nobody came back in the cave. we're all sitting there looking at the shadows.
I think if you break government down, doesn't government mean mind control?
it comes from a term Khyber for steersman, mm-hmm. in the Greek language, and that, you know, if you think about it, you know, that's not delivery of services.
No,
that is steering the society.
To be sheared and slaughtered every so often, I guess.
Yeah, right. So, right.
Well, listen, Lance, great. I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking about your book. It really is a great book, and I urge everyone to pick it up and read it. It's not long, and it's very enjoyable to read. It's a very easy read. It's well written. It spells it out. You articulate a position, which give people a way to articulate a position, understanding these things that may help them out when they're dealing with being ostracized or marginalized for entertaining some of these ideas of state crimes, high criminality,
right.
You know. It's a Conspiracy Theory in America. I urge everyone to read it. It's a great book. Is there anything else you want to add before we part?
Well, I'd just like to thank you for having me on, and I really enjoyed this conversation. You're a wealth of knowledge, and I think I could talk to you for weeks.
Well, listen, we'll talk again maybe sometime in the near future.
I'll
read your work. Come up another time or whatever developments occur in this new administration.
Right. Yeah, this is going to be some interesting times
in the
next few years.
Yeah, so let's hope. So hope for the best.
Okay.
So listen, thanks a lot, and good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Joyce Jones.